first time I would invite... Chris, why don't you sit closest to the podium here since you're wired. I'd like to invite our keynote panelist up, Susan Phillips, the executive director at New College Berkeley. And Susan will be speaking tomorrow, and she'll get a fuller introduction. And our second panelist is Rod Dreher, who will be speaking this evening and will also get a full introduction, senior editor and blogger at the American Conservative, and a book that's for sale in the bookstore called The Benedict Option.
So, you read a book?
Yeah. Thank you, Susan and Rod, and Chris, for that talk. So I'm going to follow Joel's lead from this morning. And Susan, if it's okay, I didn't warn you about this, but maybe we could have you start the comments and questions and discussion, and I'll have a seat and come back up here in a bit.
Sure. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciated the lecture, and even before that lecture, between the very fine one we heard this morning and this lecture, the way we all stood and said the Our Father together. Mm-hmm. I was very struck by that and thinking about the paper that Dr. Armstrong was going to present about incarnation, because we together were embodied communally in prayer, as we said that prayer. There aren't many instances like that in public life in the United States or in the world, I think. And yet it's something we as Christians do regularly. And it's a bonding force among us and with our Father. And I like being in this Anglican environment where we use the word trespasses. Because I grew up Episcopalian, so I grew up with the word trespass. And now I'm a Presbyterian, and we either have debts or sins. And when I have my students in classrooms stand and say that prayer together, we sin and debt people have to wait for the trespass people to catch up. And so it's a moment of actual communal attentiveness to one another as we pause and wait. And I think it's quite profound that that word about has something to do with where we have gone wrong is the one we can't agree on.
I hadn't thought about that. That's true.
And I love it that we here use trespasses because it is embodied, right? It has to do with taking steps and maybe taking steps in the wrong direction. So I spent my flights here yesterday rereading this book, Armstrong's book, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians, and no one on the plane asked me about it.
Did they like move away from you?
I saw them asking other people about People magazine and things like that. But I think people are a little intimidated by something with the words medieval and Christian in the title. And we have, out in public, a suppression of that kind of conversation about faith.
Sure.
Though I think we do have a general appreciation of it when it happens in odd moments. Like there's some terrible disaster that happens and people show up in the evening with candles and sing whatever few songs we still all know, Kumbaya or something like that, sometimes Christian spirituals. That's when our social and material embodiment in something larger suddenly becomes apparent. Whereas most of the times, I think it is completely eclipsed by our fragmented, networked lives. So I think this attention to incarnation is crucial. I teach spiritual disciplines and engage in a few, and I'm a sociologist by training, so it's very intimidating to be here with all these people who are steeped in history and theology and can pronounce sacerdotalism. But in reading your book, I was very appreciative of the reclaiming and correcting of the sacramental. And why you, in the beginning of this talk in the book, use the word sacerdotalism, and you retrieve it in a way through talking about the social body, community. I'm wondering about the retrieval of correction of sacerdotalism itself.
Oh,
as
boy.
What?
I said, oh boy. I don't really go far with that because I wasn't sure what to do with it. But I would say, I mean, I think this comes out again in the kind of authority structures in Benedictine monasticism, which says that obedience is an essential spiritual discipline. And so there's a function of a leader, which is you can't find anywhere else. You have to have it. And it's not lost to Protestantism. I mean, Wesley understood it and used it, you know. Even in America, it continues to be used. I remember reading the autobiography of Peter Cartwright, this like 1830s, you know, rough and tumble, you know, fist punching Wesleyan circuit rider or Methodist circuit rider. He shows up at somebody's house at one point because they had to stay at people's houses, and he walks in, and there's the family, and he realizes pretty quickly that the father is not leading morning devotions. Well, that's not good. And so he, next morning, gets up, gathers the family without, you know, the father in the picture, goes downstairs and very ostentatiously leads them in devotions. And the father comes down the stairs and he's very upset and he's embarrassed and he comes, of course, this is Cartwright's telling of his own life. He comes around, Cartwright is the star of the story and so on. But when I read that the first time, I just thought, I can't imagine a modern religious leader being allowed to do that. I can't imagine that scenario. We don't have the structures for it. We don't have the same theology of what a religious leader can do in our lives. So maybe that's a partial answer. You know, whether it looks like you know, bishops and hierarchy and popes, or whether it I think there are other forms for that recognition that we need human mediation in different ways. And I think it's of a piece with the mediation of tradition. Do we accept things? Do we value things that come to us from people long dead? Chesterton said the democracy of the dead, you know, as opposed to the oligarchy of those who just happen to be walking around. I mean, why don't we go back to some of those teachers? So those are the two things that come to mind.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I really appreciate you prompting me to think about it, because as I teach in different seminaries, I've noticed that the sort of degree or certificate that's proliferating at seminaries has leadership in the title.
Mm, oh yeah, right. Well, what does that mean in a sort of a flat democratic society? Who are you leading? Yeah, great. Thanks, Susan.
Well, I have to thank you so much for that talk, Chris. I mean, it thrills me to be also here at an evangelical seminary and to see, as I've gone around the country talking about the Benedict Option book, how the welcome I've received from evangelicals. I don't know the evangelical world. I was not raised evangelical. I was sort of, you know, we weren't big churchgoers. We were Methodist, and the church we didn't go to was a Methodist church. But I came to Christ as an adult. It started with walking into a medieval cathedral at Chartres and just being overwhelmed by the wonder. And my entire experience of Christianity as an adult, serious Christianity, has been sacramental. So when I walk into evangelical settings, I don't often know what I'm walking into. And I've gotten some pushback, of course, but it has been thrilling to me to see younger evangelicals, theologians, and others who seem to understand that there has to be some recovery of sacramentalism if we're going to survive through what we're going through now. I had lots of thoughts during your talk, but the first thing that occurred to me was it reminded me of a show called Tudor Monastery Farm. Have you seen that?
Oh, I'm going to rush out and get that. Is that on Netflix?
You can see it on YouTube.
Okay, it's, YouTube. Tudor Monastery Farm.
Tudor Monastery Farm. It's a reality series. It's in 6 episodes. It's on, again, it's on YouTube. One of the British production companies does it. And what they do is they have 3 historians who live on and recreate a Tudor monastery farm. And what they're trying to do is look at all aspects of life in the Tudor period. It's set in 1500, just before the dissolution. And a lot of it is about technology and social habits and things like that. But a very large amount of it is about religion. And at one point in the show, the woman, there are two men and a woman, historians, she's an atheist. And she just burst out saying, I had no idea how much religion was just woven into everyday life. And she's delighted by it.
It seems impossible today.
Right, right. And the delight that she feels, the re-enchantment of the world just by getting involved and doing it. And this is someone who has studied this stuff academically, but there was something about putting her hands on it and doing these things and reenacting these rituals that helped her to absorb it in a new way. I'm wondering, and I'd love to hear what you both have to say about this. In writing The Benedict Option, I came across some work by a cultural anthropologist, social anthropologist named Paul Connerton at Cambridge, who highlighted to me how we can draw on the social sciences and go outside of a purely religious or philosophical argument to recover sacramentalism. He wrote a thin, dense book called How Societies Remember. And he's talking about, he went to look at different kind of traditional societies that had weathered modernity, the intentional severing of our links with the past, who had come through it more or less intact. And he wanted to find out what aspects did they share, what qualities did they share that could that we could learn from. And he said that there were a few things they had in common. First of all, they had a sacred story. They told the sacred story in a communal ritual. That ritual gave them, that it was a shared sense that in that ritual, they were outside of time. They were connecting the temporal to the eternal, the transcendent to the immanent. And the ritual, this was so interesting, the rituals have to involve the body. Because Connerton said somehow when you tell the sacred story in ways that involve the body, the truths it tells become sedimented into the bone. I love that phrase, sedimented into the bone. So I'm curious to know what you both think about that, about what we might learn in that respect from the social sciences and even the hard sciences that can help us as Christians learn how to recover the sacramental and make it plausible to people. It's not just this, as you say, it's not just a happy, clappy hobby, but something we really need that speaks to our truest nature.
I think we should ask the sociologist.
I do think that story is crucial. The transmission of the story and the fact that the word narrative comes from the word na, which has to do with knowledge. We learn truth through story in a much more full-bodied way that sediments into us. That's also a Merleau-Ponty term. I like to think about how we metabolize the truths that we learn, and we metabolize them more fully if we're engaged in them communally, physically, and with the depth that story has. Story evokes physiological response. That's the mechanism through which story gets enfleshed. And then it gets expressed in a similar way by a physical trigger, like Proust smelling the Madeleines, and that evokes a feeling which leads to story, a long story in his case. So I think that's absolutely true. I think the popular culture understands this to some degree as well, but the problem with some of the popular culture's disciplines that are put forward is they're pretty elitist. They're not portable, democratically available, communally corrected, or accessible to people across the economic continuum.
But how do you mean?
Well, people get into bodywork practices, and so they can go and have a massage, or they take a a bodywork weekend. That's not very accessible to a person who lives in the inner city and is trying to feed five children as a single person earning minimum wage. The beauty and the gospel truth of the disciplines that are available to the church and have come down through the church history is that they are democratically accessible. People can go into churches, and even if they can't read the scripture, they have the gospel of the poor in the stained glass windows.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Was that, I'm not cutting you off, right? Okay. Rod, if I heard you correctly, you're also asking how can the church use, benefit from, engage with the social sciences, right?
I mean, towards regaining sacramentalism. Towards regaining. So it's not simply a theological or philosophical argument.
I mean, you know, in as much as, you know, the recovery of Aristotelian science helped the scholastic theologians re-engage the created world, I really think that's true. I think it helps us understand a lot of what happened from the 12th century on. What about if the social sciences tell us things that are true about us as embodied beings in the second sense, in the social sense, everything that it tells us should give us a better sense of how we're created to be. There's no reason that can't be interwoven with a theological understanding of who we are, just as the scholastics were, I think, successfully able to interweave a not explicitly Christian sort of natural explanation of the world into their theology.
Well, I think that we have to combat we're in a really difficult culture for that sort of thing. We're in a culture of immediacy and a culture in which we radically reject the idea, I say we, meaning all of us, radically reject the idea that there is an embodied nature, there is a logos running through things. I mean, try to tell people today, you can't even say that there's a such thing as male and female nature without causing a ruckus. So we have to, I mean, and this is such, it's a given in our society that there is nothing. There's no truth that is not chosen, you know. And there may be it's a nihilistic point of view, but I'm shocked, and probably none of you are. But want to see how many kids get this? They just breathe it in. This is the water in which they swim, in which we all swim. It makes me wonder that about whether we do have to step away from the world in ways that is. That are not accustomed, that evangelicals are not accustomed to, and I'll tell you why. A few years ago when I was having a real spiritual crisis, my priest gave me the Jesus Prayer, an hour of Jesus Prayer a day for contemplation, and I thought this was stupid. Just give me a book to read so I can know what to do. It turned out that was the wisest thing he could have done because it made me step outside of myself and find stillness within myself and focus for an hour a day, and this had a therapeutic effect over time. I thought about this recently when I read a book by a guy, Tim Wu, who teaches at Columbia. It's a history of modern advertising. And at the very end of the book, he talks about how advertisers have worked so diligently and they're so expert at capturing our attention to the point now where we don't even have to make a decision. They know which buttons to push. Wu says, you know, we really need to go back to the Middle Ages because the medieval monks, they knew that we are what we pay attention to, and they knew that we had to discipline our attention. And this is how he ends the book, and it's really kind of an apocalyptic book, totally secular. So I'm wondering, though, if we Christians have to do something radical about stepping away from the world just so we can contemplate and understand where we are and how to respond to it.
There's a really, as you started to talk about that, I was thinking about, though, if we take seriously a theology of suffering, you know, Martin Luther did, and others did in the medieval period, that says that, God may get to us just in the midst rather than out of stepping away. The primary early medieval example I can think of is Gregory the Great. He was a monk. He was forced to become a pope, thought he would actually lose his salvation by becoming pope, begged the emperor to let him off, and agonized for years afterwards about how he was going to keep his salvation now that he had to do all of this administrivia and deal with the dailiness of life and people's problems and all of that. And he developed a theology of the active and the contemplative life, with the active life being those places where you go out and you, in love and fear and suffering, serve other people, and you come back bruised and tattered, and it's a symbiotic relationship. You're driven from one to the other and from the other back to the one. It's like a slow dance. But if you're missing, he finally decided, in his book, The Pastoral Rule, that this mixed life, which this, right? The people who are called the religious, and still today, it's in your idiom, in Roman Catholic idiom, are those who follow a rule or those who are cloistered. And the seculars include the priests, because the priests have to deal with that. They can't escape that world. And so what Gregory essentially evolved was a theology of inescapable secular engagement that did not at all deny the suffering. Okay, so this is the guy who also went on to write 40, count them, 40 books on Job, right? Because this is where it led him. He had to go through that, and I don't know whether it was before or after that he developed this theology. But I mean, I'm not saying that is for everyone, nor was Gregory, right? And I know you've heard this a million times. It's this engagement you've done ever since you wrote the book about, are you saying that we have to go away? And then that's an abdication of responsibility.
I've heard that.
Have you? Once or twice?
Yeah.
But I'm a little shy of saying it's a have to, that the church or that any individual has to step aside, because I think sometimes maybe that's because our therapeutic culture is getting the best of us and we want to have it all be nice, and wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to?
Well, I guess what I'm saying, though, is as you say, the sort of symbiotic and the cycle, yeah. You know, that you have to step aside so you can go back out.
Absolutely.
But why
for seasons, but not as a lifelong thing. Right.
Why do evangelicals have so much trouble
even doing that?
Yeah, or why does it make them so nervous to talk about contemplation? No, the contemplative life, I mean, as opposed to the active life.
I don't think moderns, let alone evangelicals, and we are moderns, know what to do when something isn't continually changing every few seconds, like a TV image, right? We don't know how to, you have a silent retreat with kids, you get them to turn their cell phones off, they implode, they have existential crises, they don't know how to handle that, so.
This is what I call the circus, where we're either performing or we're spectating. And it's the opposite of the active and the contemplative, both of which are engaged postures. The circus has the performer and the spectator, which are not engaged with their deeper selves and with others.
In as much as the performer's about their own performance, that's certainly true. And then you're passive as a spectator. Yeah, that's really good. I like that. It's very helpful.
Can I break up one more thing? No, I don't like it when evangelicals put themselves down too much for not having the sacramentalism, because I have seen so often, you know, coming from the Orthodox and Eastern Orthodox and Catholic side, that, you know, we have the sacramentalism, we have those roots, but evangelicals are often leading much more Christian lives or Catholic and Orthodox lives than we are, you know. So the outward forms don't do it, aren't enough. What can evangelicals give to help reinvigorate we in the who come from liturgical sacramental traditions?
Great question. I there is a good side to activism. There's a reason why, you know, evangelicals, they see a need and it's straightforward. It's sort of this can-do American things. Like, we got to go deal with that. We got it. We got to go start drilling wells. We got to cure this disease. We got to. And I don't think God is displeased with that. And it's interesting because I think, you know, the mainline Protestantism has something very similar. They approach it from different angles, but there's a sense that God, this life with God has to make a difference in the world. But I think it gets limited and it gets narrowed. But in terms of the energy, the willingness to commit, the sacrifice, the understanding that sometimes God does deal with us in crisis moments and big commitments, you know, hey, we're great at that stuff. I think what's harder for us is the long, continuous, like, I'm not going on a short-term mission trip. I'm going to go and give my life to those people. There, maybe we need to go and look at monasticism. We need to look at the Catholic and the evangelical. It can be, and the Orthodox. It would definitely be a mutually beneficial conversation.
And I would add, and it's appropriate at this conference, that when I'm teaching with Catholic colleagues, they say that they can tell I'm an evangelical because my Bible looks used. And I tell the students anything I'm teaching in this Christian seminary context, they can question me based on how it relates to or doesn't relate to Scripture. And that is different from what I find with some people in other traditions.
Yeah. Do you know Patrick Reardon in Chicago? He said that once to me. He's like, yeah, you know, if we have an issue, it's a sort of biblical illiteracy. So.
Well, we want to use the remainder of our time for any questions from anyone here in the audience. And there's someone running vigorously to get to the microphone. So.
That's either a good sign or I should be worried.
It's a good sign. Thanks so much for this conversation. It's been really enjoyable and really great. So I love the term immediatism. It's a really helpful term for me. I think packed within that is both the rejection of mediation and the devotion to immediacy. And I think so it's a great word. So the context that I find myself in a lot of the time is this sort of, is a Christian context that has a real deep-seated suspicion of mediation, of all of the different types of mediation. You mentioned a lot of them. Something coming to mind is confession to a priest, liturgy, the tradition, even a non-memorial view of the sacraments, a lot of the things that you talked about. So I find C.S. Lewis is probably a great bridge for reaching Christian audiences that have that kind of deep suspicion because of his popularity in the evangelical church. I was wondering if you could say anything else about what language might be helpful in speaking into those kind of contexts and addressing the suspicion, but aware of the suspicion and trying to speak still to the importance of this embodied life.
Lewis, since we're talking about Lewis, his little essay Transposition, I think, is wonderful on this. I mean, it starts with the question, why do Christians insist on having an image of God the Father with the gray beard? And why are they always referring to these patently sort of material images in their tradition? I remember two Indians sitting on top of a train in the movie Gandhi, or an Indian and a Westerner, and the Indian, he says, yeah, I drink blood every Sunday, blood of Christ. You can see the Westerner guy going, oh, wait a minute. But Lewis goes on and he says, what else do we have? I mean, we're physical beings. We're human beings. We have senses. That's how we know stuff. And to try to go beyond that into the ineffable, there is, of course, part of the Christian tradition, apophatic part of the tradition, which is strong in Orthodoxy, that says at some point you have to acknowledge that it just goes beyond your ken, and there's a fruitfulness to that spiritually. But I think that's a language I think about. Another one, I didn't say it in the talk, but a friend of mine is who I've taught with before is a marriage counselor, evangelical marriage counselor, often gets Christian couples. And one of them, in many cases, has become so absorbed in the experience and the joy and the benefit of being in church that they're ignoring their spouse. They don't know how to function when they get home. And You know, when, as soon as he said that to me, I remembered writing my dissertation on the holiness movement after the Civil War in the basement of Duke University Library, microfilm, and I hit this 1875 holiness newspaper, and somebody says, you know what, the problem today is, it's great to have all these experiences, but there's too many people who are going out and having a great old time in church and who are just terrible to be with at home and don't understand the horizontal dimension, don't understand that there's a social part to what it means to be Christian. And I think you know, that's recognizable for those evangelicals who've fallen into this sort of overheated, intense sort of cult of the crisis experience, the rally, the big meeting, the thing that comes in a flash, and have gotten so vertically oriented. We can recognize that. We've seen that, and some of us have grown up in families that have been marked by that. And I think we got to get real honest, real quick about. You know, God, the relationship God desires with us is not exclusive of the relationship we have with others, that there are some basic responsibilities. Somebody needs to do the sort of relational equivalent of what Paul does in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. It's like, don't be busybodies, work. If you're not going to work, don't eat. You know, make it your ambition to live a quiet life. I mean, there's a basic kind of ethic of what it is to be a human being that you got to do and that you can get distracted from in this sort of overcharged, hyper-spiritual way of handling faith. So anyway, there's a couple of things I'd say.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, I just wanted to say that we learn by analogy. I think about how not long ago, it was really a surprise to me, I showed my kids the film Babette's Feast, which is just perhaps the greatest cinematic depiction of sacramentalism that ever was. And my kids, I realized as we were talking about the movie afterwards that this movie helped them understand what was going on in the Eucharist and in church better than the straightforward explanations my wife and I gave them. And that itself is a sacramental point. I think also about how I was going through the deepest spiritual crisis of my life, which became a physical crisis too, and God in his mercy conked me over the head with the Divine Comedy. And I realized as I was going through it, and God used that work of art to heal me, Dante was explaining to me through reading this work of art, God's mercies, healing mercies came to me, in part because I understood as I was researching it that, as Susan was saying, their stories, narrative causes a physical response inside us. I was stunned to learn that neuroscientists have shown that if they hand the subjects nonfiction, but making an argument, a propositional argument, they'll measure their brain waves, then they'll hand them a piece of fiction that embodies the same argument but in a story. The parts in their brains light up that didn't light up before. Like if somebody is walking, the parts of their brain that would light up if they were walking themselves light up. So that is a way showing the incarnation and sacramentalism. So I think maybe we can help overcome people's fear of mediation by talking. Take it out of the church context and just talk about story, and then work from there back to church.
Good. Any other questions? Would anyone else like to run to the microphone with a question? Yeah. Or walk. That's fine.
This question may be a little too Anglican nerdy, but I hope you can speak to it. A few decades after Tudor Monastery Farm, Henry VIII wiped out all the monasteries. And so at the time of the Anglican Reformation, they were gone. So how has that affected the development of Anglican Christianity or more generally Anglo-American Christianity? And do you think that affects for good or ill our ability to reclaim these medieval ways and wisdom that you've been talking about?
That being the loss of a monastic fabric to Anglican
the total
faith?
Absence of that fabric at the time of the development of the Reformation in England, as I understand it, and beyond.
Haven't thought much about that. I'm sure it was not good. It sounds like the right answer.
Well, he said Anglo-American, so yeah. Come on, where's the Americanist?
Where's the American part of this? I mean, you have, then by the time you get to America, you have an almost completely unmediated kind of way of talking about faith. I think The most helpful thing I read on this is in the book Evangelical Ecclesiology by John Stackhouse. And Bruce Hindmarsh, a friend of mine at Regent College, has the first chapter on that. And he talks about absolutely everything is up for grabs in evangelical ecclesiology because there is no fixed communal form. There is no fixed structure. And so there's you and God, and everything else is negotiable. And if I were to link that to sort of historical reasons, I'd put Zwingli in there. I'd probably also put what you just mentioned, the loss of a very significant and tremendously widespread communal form, which even for those who weren't in it was consistently a sort of imaginative form and a model for lay spirituality. So,
and maybe if I could just comment on that real quick as a monastic historian, and that is in the 12th century with the rise of what's called the profit economy, people could quit working their own land but still purchase food, right? Because a profit economy. So you had money to use to buy things. It made you more mobile. It took you away from your home, and it kind of disembodied you to an extent from that rootedness historically, and the Franciscans in part were a response to that. As a way to try to minister to those people. So in as much as the 16th century exacerbated things in one context, they had already started earlier, maybe in a context like that when it came to the ability to just move around and be a little less fully active in the world around you. So, well, Rod,
I want to say real quick to that point, it's fascinating to me to think about how the Western world began to lose this sacramentalism long before the Reformation. I mean, Hans Boersma's talked about theologically how this happened. And Eric Auerbach, the literary critic, said only 40 years separate Dante from Petrarch, but the world shifted in that 40 years towards more of an outward individualism than the sacramental, spiritual transcendentalism that the Middle Ages had.
Absolutely. Good. Well, I think, is it quick? Sharon? Okay, if it's real quick.
Thank you so much. And I think that we're seeing a rise of disembodiment in society, and I'm thinking about virtual reality and, you know, rooms full of people texting each other, maybe even in the same room. But my question is, and this is real short, the church, most large churches now have live streaming of services, and clearly that's not a substitution for the Eucharist, etc. But is that actually a danger, or is that just a nice substitute for snowstorms and when you're sick? Thank you.
Is live streaming a church service a danger, or habitually perhaps? I mean, if you mean staying home and just watching it, I don't think that's good, because you're disembodying that worship experience. I just don't see how that can be ultimately helpful, although convenient for a season. I mean, right? Sometimes there are arguments that say that community was irrevocably lost in America at some point, and it's always a different point, you know, 1830, 1850, 1900. And it's quite valid to say, well, there's just different kinds of community that are rising. The town, the small neighborhood, everybody knows your name. Those people move into the city. Does that mean that community, that Gemeinschaft has been destroyed, and there's nothing but society, there's nothing but Gesellschaft? No, but you have to read the signs and see that there are different ways that people come together. I think as long as there are ways that people are coming together, I mean, maybe that person's going to a small group. Right, and then I would be less worried about the fact that they're watching a worship service on a screen. But our lives are so dominated with screens now, it does make me a little nervous. And I've seen the impact on my own children. So I don't know if that's helpful, but
yeah. Well, with that, we need to end. Let's thank Dr. Armstrong and our panelists.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.